Hi, we're Roused by Nature.
And you're listening to
CITR
101.9, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yo tengo una criatura máxima con estresa mínima. Las ideas dulces principales y una actitud gira. Yeah! Yeah! Yo tengo una criatura máxima y ella todo sobre mí. Como razas extranjeras, una enfermedad dulce. Espero tener la mejor cosa hoy. Espero tener la mejor cosa hoy. Si puedo volar a su México. Con destreza mínima, como razas extranjeras, una enfermedad dulce. Yeah! Yeah! Espero tener la mejor cosa.
It's the 50 Shades of Fear edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week we look at the anti-terror bill, the TransLink referendum, and sleep. Why you do it, and why you need it. Let's begin episode 290.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the new proposed bill that would make every one of us guilty of terrorism. I'm talking about Bill C-51. What is Bill C-51? Well, just in case you managed to somehow miss it on the news, the protests, the political posturing, this is ostensibly our nation's legislative response to the terrorism, and more specifically, ISIS. I must admit, I'm surprised that it took this long for Harper to roll out this bill. One would have thought it would have had a smoother ride had it been introduced in the days or weeks after the shooting on Parliament Hill. I suspect that Harper was torn between the rush to action that coincides with tragedy and the possibilities of using this as an election issue. Well, as it turns out, it definitely appears to be an election issue, although early days, with Harper trying to scare people into voting conservatives, the NDP being the champions of freedom, and the Liberals under Trudeau, the junior, sounding incoherent as they simultaneously say they support the bill while pledging to fix the deeply flawed bill, if only they were elected. Wink, wink. Why all the fuss? Well, there are three main areas of contention. The radical revision of CSIS, the wording, and the lack of oversight. I'll save the radical revision of CSIS for another show. Just know that CSIS was created in response to the McDonald Commission report in 1981, which saw the RCMP abusing its combined powers of surveillance and enforcement. CSIS was given great powers to collect information regarding national security. It is allowed to do this under the cover of darkness so as to preserve its operations. As a counter to this power, it was purposely made impotent when it came to actual law enforcement. It would advise and inform the other entities, such as the RCMP, to go after the bad guys. CSIS acted as an informal check and balance. Bill C-51 will make CSIS our equivalent to the KGB or Gestapo. As I said, more on that later. Now, the area we should be most worried about is, at least now, is the slight but important change in language used in the criminal code. First is the change in the term will to may. This in regards to the probability of a terrorist act being carried out. The old law says a person can be preemptively arrested and detained if an officer believes, on reasonable grounds, that a terrorist activity will be carried out. Now, the law says they can do this if there's reasonable ground to believe that an act may be carried out. Going hand in hand with this change, another word swap lowers the bar even more. It now states that law enforcement agencies can arrest and detain you if doing so is, quote, necessary to the prevention of a terrorist act. The new wording says that you can be locked up if it is likely to prevent an attack. Now, you might be thinking this is not much of a difference, but legally it shifts the burden of proof from an evidence-based probability to a mere possibility. The previous act required hard evidence, and the latter only a belief of evidence. The purpose of both changes is to broaden the discretion officers have to arrest you or put you on a no-fly list. They no longer need evidence, but could go on gut feeling alone. Or better to arrest them all than risk one of them being a bad guy. This law allows government agents to lock up Canadian citizens on pure conjecture, without a shred of evidence. This bill will introduce a new crime of pre-terrorism, where the onus is on the accused to prove their innocence, as well as make the claim that the RCMP were unreasonable in their arrest. How exactly do I prove I am not going to burn down GM Place next week? It is possible that I might. Who is the arbitrator of the word possible? One example I heard goes like this. It's late, an officer sees a group of young men of an ethnic persuasion engaging in a heated discussion in a foreign language. To the officer, they appear nervous. Based on the stereotype in his head, he swoops in and arrests them all, and they can be held indefinitely. The burden of proof relies on them to show that they're not a threat. It is already the law of the realm that people can be put in preventative detention, but this power can only be applied to people who have already committed a criminal offense. Bill C-51 would mean that if it were possible you might commit a crime, you could be held indefinitely. In fiction, this was called pre-crime. Seems in the land of Harper, fiction can become reality. 1984, anyone? How, may I ask, can you be expected to prove you're not going to commit a crime tomorrow, especially when the act of incarceration is known to be a factor in radicalization of individuals? I wait to see what the Supreme Court has to say on this. And there's more. Not only is the threshold for your arrest lower, but what qualifies as terrorism will be expanded. This occurs in two ways. First, in a direct challenge to our rights of free speech, Harper has made it a crime to advocate or promote, quote, terrorism offenses in general. On the face of that, you might not think this is a bad thing. We've all had a full court press of our own propaganda as to how groups like ISIS use social media to recruit. Bill C-51 says that anyone who communicates or advocates for the commission of a terrorist act in general, irrespective of whether said act violates Canadian law, can be arrested. Where this gets dangerous is the line that states, or being reckless as to where any of these offenses may be committed, is likewise guilty. What does that mean, the reckless part? Well, I guess it depends on who you are. The resources I've called upon state that a program like Radio Free Thinker could be guilty of this because of our advocacy we've done vis-a-vis the Palestinian movement. We have never advocated violence. Our push has been to support of a state of Palestine. Now, under Bill C-51, if a listener sends money to Gaza, whose government is Hamas, a designated terrorist group according to our dear leader, well, if I knew such a donation was possible, then I could be arrested and off to jail I go. Trust me, as I was preparing for this show, this scenario crossed my mind, and it sent a chill down my spine. And having had that thought leaves me wondering, just what kind of country are we living in? Now, you might point out that we already have laws that limit free speech, notably when concerning hate speech or pedophilia, which is true. But first, these are very narrowly defined domains, whereas this law uses an extremely broad and nebulous term, terrorism offenses in general. That said, previous limitations were only on public speech. This law includes private speech, a very dark milestone for this nation if it comes to pass. And to the line, terrorism offenses in general is added other than an offense under this section. What exactly does that mean? The criminal code already contains 14 broadly worded terrorism offenses. Terrorism activities defined under S-8301 of the criminal code. But this is broader. It applies to more than speech advocating or promoting terrorist activities or the 14 terrorism offenses in the criminal code. The new offense is meant to include promoting or advocating terrorism in general, a deliberately opaque and esoteric term. Basically, any definition of terrorism that is not included in the law will be deemed inclusive. So it means whatever the government wants it to mean. Scary times ahead, my friends. The other way this law will turn more people into, quote, terrorists, at least in the government's eyes, is what qualifies as a terrorist act. Well, actually, Bill C-51 is intended to, quote, stop activities that undermine the security of Canada. This includes terrorism, but also includes, quote, causes harm to a person or their property because of that person's association with Canada. Proliferation of nuclear, chemical, radiological, or biological weapons. Espionage, sabotage, or covert foreign-influenced activities. So far, I think we're all on board. But it also includes interference with the economic and financial stability of Canada. Interference with critical infrastructure. Changing or unduly influencing a government in Canada by force or unlawful means. And that last one is important because defenders of C-51 point out that it explicitly states that, and again I quote, for greater certainty, it does not include lawful advocacy, protest, dissent, and artistic expression. Oh, you might say, this means those claims about arresting protesters as terrorists is a bunch of hokey. Well, not so fast. Because we live in a relatively free society, we forget that most of our protests are technically illegal. There was no permit attained to that march downtown in Granville to protest the Keystone Pipeline. Or perhaps the chanting was a little too loud, blocking a sidewalk with posters decrying one injustice or another. And what does it mean if I protest? The term civil disobedience means breaking the law to draw attention to a cause, something used innumerable times to forward social progress. Well, instead of being charged with disturbing the peace, breaking a noise bylaw, or trespassing, no, now we could be facing a number of terrorist charges. And what about the line regarding the economic stability of Canada? We are a resource-dependent nation. The drop of oil prices has caused instability. What if it was argued that protests against the tar sands was related to the drop? You might be charged again. And there's that other line about covert foreign-influenced activities. Again, on the one hand, if it means the North Korea is trying to hack into our computers, okay, that's a bad thing. But what about if you had Greenpeace or an American charity that's trying to reduce the carbon footprint? Is that covert foreign influencing of activities in Canada? We don't know yet. All that is scary in its own right, but let us remember these charges include the pre-crime offenses. So if you're planning a march on Parliament Hill, where you may commit one of these new acts of terrorism, you could be locked up as a preemptive measure. That is the reality of a nation where pre-crime is the law of the land. Oh yes, and there's another change. The CSIS Act states actions could be taken to prevent, quote, threats to the security of Canada. Bill C-51 changes that to activities that undermine the security of Canada. What constitutes a threat is more obvious than what constitutes undermining. Oh yes, and in case you missed it, we will soon have our own no-fly list, which means the Minister of Public Safety can put any Canadian on a no-fly list, which prevent them from boarding an airplane. The minister can add anyone to the no-fly list on the mere suspicion that the person might engage in an act that would threaten transportation security or travel by air for the purpose of committing an act of terrorism. And what happens if they get it wrong? Well, first, you not only have to prove you are not a threat, but that the minister, by putting you on that list, acted unreasonably. Furthermore, the appeal can be held wholly or in part under the veil of secrecy. So not only is the accused not present, but their legal counsel is excluded as well. So the judge can, based on what the Crown says, take this evidence against you, which you cannot challenge because you don't know what it is, and use it as the basis, perhaps solely, for their decision. What could go wrong? South of the border, the no-fly list has proven to be a complete disaster as numbers of people, likely the majority, have been placed on this list erroneously, like having a similar name to someone who's a, quote, real threat. And another big problem is there's no actual oversight of CSIS in performing these acts. If CSIS preemptively tries to disrupt, quote, terrorist activities, there is no one that they're accountable to before they do the act. There is some ability in review where after they did it, someone comes, does sort of like an audit on it, and then they say, oh, you really shouldn't have done this or you really shouldn't have done that. But it's after the fact. It's too late. In the United States, they have a particular system where you have to preemptively go and get approval before you do these kinds of acts. It is not a, oh, let's see what you did wrong. It's like, oh, should you actually be doing this? And as flawed as it is, it at least provides some oversight. In fact, there is no actual parliamentary oversight over CSIS. It's left up to a particular committee that's run by a retired judge, but there's no public accountability. And that's another problem people are having with this law. And what are the critics saying? Well, I'll keep this part short. Thomas Mulcair commented on the Prime Minister's action, saying, the job of the Prime Minister is to try and reduce the fears of Canadians. Instead, Harper is trying to fundraise on fear, and that's shameful. Now, I think the best response, to people who speak from experience about where laws such as Bill C-51 will lead, the National Association of Japanese Canadians. They have publicly joined other concerned Canadians in calling for the Government of Canada to withdraw Bill C-51. They believe the Bill C-51 threatens Canadian civil liberties and freedoms. The National Association of Japanese Canadians is confident that the current existing laws and powers are adequate in safeguarding our security against acts of terrorism. And to be fair, the government has not actually made any case as to why they need these new powers. The Japanese Association continued in stating that, and I quote, public safety and perceived insurrection were the reasons given for the Japanese internment during World War II, an extraordinary violation of human rights and citizenship at the time. We can't say it won't happen here again, folks. Our current government has a proven track record of abusing power. Let us not forget the CIA witch hunt against charities that do not hold the same ideological beliefs as the conservatives hold, while adamantly denying such bias. We are already far along a very dark road. We just don't see it yet. 2015, never forget. We will return after this break.
Fund Drive 2015. 0, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000,
Fund Drive 2015 has concluded with a bang. We're almost at our $40,000 goal, which will allow us to complete the digitization of our reel-to-reel archives and make decades worth of independent radio history accessible online. And because our current site is full of kinks and always on the verge of meltdown, this money will go towards a new website which will make accessing CITR easier than ever before. For less than the price of a coffee, pledge to help preserve CITR's past and future. Or donate more and receive great prizes. CITR apparel, framed Discorder art, a new tape which collects historic live music from CITR, and more. Go online at CITR.ca to pledge. Donate today and let's get digital.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
We're back. Now here's something listeners of Radio Free Thinker may not be aware of. I am a vocal proponent of public transport. I do this for environmental reasons, reasons concerning community and social contract. But it really started about 15 years ago when I came out from work to find my car on fire. Well, okay, not on fire, it was smoking. Well, okay, not so much smoke, but steam. You see, it was very cold out where I lived, and something seemed to have cracked while I was warming up the car. Apparently at very low temperatures, you're supposed to warm up the car before you drive it or something. It's all really kind of magic to me. But the net result is that ever since, I've used public transit and have vowed never to buy a car again. So it was with no small interest that I began listening to the transit referendum coming up at the end of this month. Now many of you are likely aware of this via the signage on buses, bus stops, etc. There has been some coverage in the local media. So let's pick at the bones of this proposal. I'll begin with the question, what is a referendum about? Well, essentially, it will increase the sales tax by 0.5%, with the additional money being earmarked for a particular set of transit upgrades. What are the upgrades? Well, first, there is the extension of SkyTrain along Broadway to Arbutus. Still not UBC, but it is getting there. The creation of light rail transit, or LRT for Surrey and Langley. Replacement of the Portillo Bridge. 11 new B-line type routes, more cars on SkyTrain, a 25% increase in bus service in general, more frequent service with 80% more night buses. I don't know why they don't have 24-hour service in this city. There will be more Handy Darts, more C-Bus, the West Coast Express service is expanded, 12 new or extended transit exchanges, including adding the capacity for 3-car trains to SkyTrain stations, more bikeway and roadway improvements in maintenance. How much will it cost? About $7.5 billion in infrastructure and an increase to the operating budget of about $80 million. Sounds great, but who's going to pay for this? Well, we are, of course. The majority of the revenue needed will be raised via government grants. It is hoped that the provincial and federal government will pony up about half of the infrastructure costs. The remaining would be financed. But to cover this cost, the Mayor's Council have proposed the aforementioned fractional increase in the PST. This is expected to raise $230 to over $300 million annually. As with most things in life, there is a yes and a no side. Duh. Now, there are several reasons to be on the yes side. If you bike or would like to bike, that will be easier with more bike lanes. If you hate getting stuck in traffic, this plan will reduce commute times by 20 minutes, more or less. If you hate waiting for the next bus, well, more buses mean less wait time, means getting to where you want to go faster. Then there's the cost. You can either pay a little now for a better tomorrow, or pay a lot later to fix the neglected system. It is expected to save the average household about $400 a year by 2025 and over a grand by 2045. Take into consideration population growth, growth that will outstrip the current funding with the system we now have. Then there's the environmental impact. Fewer cars on the road reduces noise as well as congestion. There will be tons less greenhouse gases spewing into the air. And let's not, pollution in general will be reduced with this plan. It will help unify the Lower Mainland as it becomes easier to go from downtown Langley to downtown West Vancouver, from Tawasin to Port Moody. And of course, the most important part, I can sleep an extra half hour and still get to work on time. The no sign is really three main arguments. One, it's TransLink and it's an inefficient cash cow that only keeps a few fat cats in a six-figure salary. Well, it should be made clear, this is not a referendum on TransLink, but on a very specific roadmap for the future development and infrastructure of our transit system. The money for these projects are separate from TransLink regular funding. And what about those arguments that TransLink is a haven of mismanagement? Well, it is being thrown out there that the CEO of TransLink is, to use the no sides vernacular, overpaid. They compared his salary to that of the TTC in Toronto and similar positions in Seattle, Montreal, and then threw in the PM and the Premier salary as well, just for an added oomph. And on the surface, it sounds bad. Our own CEO makes twice as much as Toronto's or Seattle CEO. But here's what's missing in this comparison. Our CEO is responsible for all the GVRD, while both Toronto and Seattle CEOs are only one of many responsible for the transit system. That is, Seattle's actually one of over a dozen sort of transit systems, each with their own management, each with their own CEO. It's the same for Toronto, where there's a separate transit authority for Mississauga, Yorkton, Brampton, etc. And if we take it the other way, the area of Toronto is about that of Vancouver, Burnaby, and New Westminster, about a quarter of the area TransLink CEO is responsible for. There are fewer higher cost employees at TransLink than in Toronto, some 400 compared to over 1,400 six-figured employees in Toronto. Another complaint about TransLink is it's inefficient, that we would not need to put more money in if only they spent the money they have more wisely. Again, compared to other jurisdictions, we get pretty good value for our money. Now, there's always anecdotal evidence that maybe TransLink should have not have sponsored those poetry panels or that there shouldn't be free coffee for the executives. No, no system is perfect, and the measure of, quote, efficiency is truly a subjective one. And even by that measure, using numbers from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, the main Vote No group, you'd save less than $2 million a year, a drop in the bucket of what TransLink needs. If you're wanting to test for efficiencies, it makes more sense to compare TransLink to other systems. A chart being tossed around is one showing Vancouver's cost effectiveness, a cost per rider that is about $4 per person compared to places like Calgary, Edmonton, Victoria, and Toronto that have cost less than $3. Sounds like a valid criticism. However, as already mentioned, the game is stacked against the GVRD, which is the only multi-city decentralized system looked at. Others have said that a better way to gauge efficiency, how much does it cost to operate a bus? Per hours of service. By using this measure, you can compensate for the fact that the ridership on a bus from South Delta will be less than that to UBC. When we run the numbers, we find that TransLink runs an operational cost per hour of about $140. the least expensive of the group, with the maximum being almost $200 from Montreal, and it's 12% cheaper than Toronto. In fact, if we reverse the view, you get more hours per $1 million spent. You get over 7,000 service hours compared to Calgary, which gets by with 11 days less of service. And that also translates to more service per capita. So we not only get more service per dollar, but more service per person as well. Another more ideological argument is that it's a tax, and taxes are just bad. Okay? This, of course, is obviously false. We live in something called a civilization. That means we believe that some things are better done communally, that which would be too expensive for an individual to pay becomes affordable when we pool our resources. Our current form of government pools our resources via taxation. Through taxation, we have schools, hospitals, mass transit as examples. Services unaffordable on a one-to-one basis, they are made available to us all, not just the fortunate few, through taxation. We should all love to pay taxes because every time we do, we're saving money. We're making our lives better. By helping others, we are helping ourselves. When everyone pays, we all pay less. Okay, now some of you may have an issue when I said every time. And you are right. And that is the last and perhaps more salient argument. It's not that we shouldn't spend more money on Translit or even Translink, but these particular projects, this plan itself, is not sound. Most of the arguments rest around the extension of SkyTrain to UBC. Well, eventually that is. But this plan only gets us to Arbutus. This particular argument says that the planned underground route is needlessly expensive when a light rail transit system, LRT, or overland routes would not only save money, but cause less disruption to locals during construction. And there are other ideas out there that may have worth. But the battle is either over or in the future. Right now, the question at hand is, do we want to fund the transit system of the future, or do we want to see it wither away from neglect, penny-pinching, or the quixotic battle for the perfect plan? I will end in two comments, I believe, explaining why this referendum will fail. The first deals with the above-mentioned criticism of SkyTrain. They said such a plan will take up to 6 years to implement. 6 years is a long bus wait. Well, ignoring the fact there would be more buses likely next year to reduce those wait, it still exemplifies the problem that we all want instant solutions, and the world does not work on that time frame. And lastly, a call into a local radio show said, SkyTrain and buses aren't frequent enough, so I'm going to vote no. I'm sorry to be impolite, but what an idiot. So when it comes time to cast your ballot, vote yes, and let's make Vancouver a better place to live. We'll be right back after this break.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
SpongeBob! You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide! I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy! Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool!
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable! Big business does it again!
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. As promised, we're going to listen to Russell Forrester as he talks about sleep. Russell Forrester is a circadian neuroscientist. He studies the sleep cycle of the brain. And he asks, what do we know about sleep? Not a lot, it turns out. And for something that we do for a third of our lives, that's pretty weird. Foster is going to share three popular theories about why we sleep, bust some myths about how much sleep we need, especially at different ages, and hints about some bold new uses for sleep as a predictor of mental health. So let's sit back and listen, and folks, try not to fall asleep.
What I'd like to do today is talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is the neuroscience of sleep. Now, there is a sound. It worked. a sound that is desperately familiar to most of us, and of course it's the sound of the alarm clock. And what that truly ghastly, awful sound does is stop the single most important behavioral experience that we have, and that's sleep. If you're an average sort of person, 36% of your life will be spent asleep, which means that if you live to 90, then 32 years will have been spent entirely asleep. Now, what that 32 years is telling us, that sleep at some level is important. And yet, for most of us, we don't give sleep a second thought. We throw it away. We really just don't think about sleep. And so what I'd like to do today is change your views, change your ideas and your thoughts about sleep. And the journey that I want to take you on, we need to start by going back in time. Enjoy the honey heavy dew of slumber. Any ideas who said that? Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Yes, let me give you a few more quotes. O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frighted thee? Shakespeare again from, I won't say it, the Scottish play. From the same time, sleep is the golden chain that ties health and our bodies together. Extremely prophetic by Thomas Dekker, another Elizabethan dramatist. But if we jump forward 400 years, the tone about sleep changes somewhat. This is from Thomas Edison from the beginning of the 20th century. Sleep is a criminal waste of time and a heritage from our cave days. Bang! And if we also jump into the 1980s, some of you may remember that Margaret Thatcher was reported to have said, sleep is for wimps. And of course, the infamous, what was his name? The infamous Gordon Gekko from Wall Street said, money never sleeps. What do we do in the 20th century about sleep? Well, of course, we used Thomas Edison's light bulb to invade the night, and we occupied the dark. And in the process of this occupation, we've treated sleep as an illness, almost. We've treated it as an enemy. At most now, I suppose, we tolerate the need for sleep, and at worst, perhaps many of us think of sleep as an illness that needs some sort of a cure. And our ignorance about sleep is really quite profound. Why is it? Why do we abandon sleep in our thoughts? Well, it's because you don't do anything much while you're asleep, it seems. You don't eat, you don't drink, and you don't have sex. Well, most of us anyway. It's a complete waste of time, right? Wrong. Actually, sleep is an incredibly important part of our biology, and neuroscientists are beginning to explain why it's so very important. So let's move to the brain. Now, here we have a brain. This is donated by a social scientist, and they said they didn't know what it was or indeed how to use it. So, so I borrowed it. I don't think they noticed. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is that when you're asleep, this thing doesn't shut down. In fact, some areas of the brain are actually more active during the sleep state than during the wake state. The other thing that's really important about sleep is that it doesn't arise from a single structure within the brain, but is to some extent a network property. And if we flip the brain on its back, I love this little bit of spinal cord here, this bit here is the hypothalamus. And right under there is a whole raft of interesting structures, not least the biological clock. The biological clock tells us when it's good to be up, when it's good to be asleep. And what that structure does is interact with a whole raft of other areas within the hypothalamus, the lateral hypothalamus, the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei. All of those combine, and they send projections down to the brainstem here. The brainstem then projects forward and bathes the cortex, this wonderfully wrinkly bit over here, with neurotransmitters that keep us awake and essentially provide us with our consciousness. So sleep arises from a whole raft of different interactions within the brain. And essentially, sleep is turned on and off as a result of a range of interactions in here. Okay, so where have we got to? We've said that sleep is complicated, and it takes 32 years of our life. But what I haven't explained is what sleep is about. So why do we sleep? And it won't surprise any of you that, of course, as scientists, we don't have a consensus. There are dozens of different ideas about why we sleep. And I'm going to outline three of those. The first is sort of the restoration idea. And it's somewhat intuitive. Essentially, all the stuff we've burnt up during the day, we restore, we replace, we rebuild during the night. And indeed, as an explanation, it goes back to Aristotle. So that's, what, 2,300 years ago. It's gone in and out of fashion. It's fashionable at the moment because what's been shown is that within the brain, a whole raft of genes have been shown to be turned on only during sleep. And those genes are associated with restoration and metabolic pathways. So there's good evidence for the whole restoration hypothesis. What about energy conservation? Again, perhaps intuitive. You essentially sleep to save calories. Now, when you do the sums, though, it doesn't really pan out. If you compare an individual who has slept at night or stayed awake and hasn't moved very much, the energy saving of sleeping is about 110 calories a night. Now, that's the equivalent of a hot dog bun. Now, I would say that a hot dog bun is kind of a meager return for such a complicated and demanding behavior as sleep. So I'm less convinced by the energy conservation idea. But the third idea I'm quite attracted to, which is brain processing and memory consolidation. What we know is that if after you've tried to learn a task and you sleep-deprive individuals, the ability to learn that task is smashed. It's really hugely attenuated. So sleep and memory consolidation is also very important. However, it's not just the laying down of memory and recalling it. What's turned out to be really exciting is that our ability to come up with novel solutions to complex problems is hugely enhanced by a night of sleep. In fact, it's been estimated to give us a threefold advantage. Sleeping at night enhances our creativity. And what seems to be going on is that in the brain, those neural connections that are important, those synaptic connections that are important, are linked and strengthened, while those that are less important tend to sort of fade away and be less important. Okay, so we've had three explanations for why we might sleep. And I think the important thing to realize is that the details will vary, and it's probably we sleep for multiple different reasons. But sleep is not an indulgence. It's not some sort of thing that we can take on board rather casually. I think sleep was once likened to an upgrade from economy to business class, you know, the equivalent of. It's not even an upgrade from economy to first class. The critical thing to realize is that if you don't sleep, you don't fly. Essentially, you never get there. And what's extraordinary about much of our society these days is that we are desperately sleep-deprived. So let's now look at sleep deprivation. Huge sectors of society are sleep-deprived, and let's look at our sleepometer. So in the 1950s, good data suggests that most of us were getting around about 8 hours of sleep a night. Nowadays, we sleep 1.5 to 2 hours less every night. So we're in the sort of 6.5 hours every night league. For teenagers, it's worse, much worse. They need 9 hours for full brain performance, and many of them on a school night are only getting 5 hours of sleep. It's simply not enough. If we think about other sectors of society, the aged. If you are aged, then your ability to sleep in a single block is somewhat disrupted, and many sleep, again, less than 5 hours a night. Shift work is extraordinary. Perhaps 20% of the working population, and the body clock does not shift with the demands of working at night. It's locked onto the same light-dark cycle that the rest of us. So when the poor old shift worker is going home to try and sleep during the day, desperately tired, the body clock is saying, wake up, this is the time to be awake. So the quality of sleep that you get as a night shift worker is usually very poor, again in that sort of 5 hour region. And then of course, tens of millions of people suffer from jet lag. So who here has jet lag? Well, my goodness gracious. Well, thank you very much indeed for not falling asleep, because that's what your brain is craving. One of the things that the brain does is indulge in microsleeps, this involuntary falling asleep, and you have essentially no control over it. Now, microsleeps can be sort of somewhat embarrassing, but they can also be deadly. It's been estimated that 31% of drivers will fall asleep at the wheel at least once in their life. And in the US, the statistics are pretty good. 100,000 accidents on the freeway have been associated with tiredness, loss of vigilance, and falling asleep. 100,000 a year is extraordinary. At another level of terror, we dip into the tragic accidents at Chernobyl and indeed the Space Shuttle Challenger, which was so tragically lost. And in the investigations that followed those disasters, poor judgment as a result of extended shift work and loss of vigilance and tiredness was attributed to be a big chunk of those disasters. So, when you're tired and you lack sleep, you have poor memory, you have poor creativity, you have increased impulsiveness, and you have overall poor judgment. But my friends, it's so much worse than that. If you are a tired brain, the brain is craving things to make it up. So drugs, stimulants, caffeine represents the stimulant of choice across much of the Western world. Much of the day is fueled by caffeine, and if you're a really naughty, tired brain, nicotine. And of course, you're fueling the waking state with these stimulants. And then, of course, it gets to 11 o'clock at night, and the brain says to itself, well, actually, I need to be asleep fairly shortly. What do we do about that when I'm feeling completely wired? Well, of course, you then resort to alcohol. Now, alcohol, short-term, you know, once or twice, to use to mildly sedate you, can be very useful. It can actually ease the sleep transition. But what you must be so aware of is that alcohol doesn't provide sleep, a biological mimic for sleep. It sedates you. So it actually harms some of those neural processing that's going on during memory consolidation and memory recall. So it's a short-term acute measure, but for goodness sake, don't become addicted to alcohol as a way of getting to sleep every night. Another connection between loss of sleep is weight gain. If you sleep around about 5 hours of less every night, then you have a 50% likelihood of being obese. What's the connection here? Well, sleep loss seems to give rise to the release of the hormone ghrelin, the hunger hormone. Ghrelin is released, it gets to the brain says, I need carbohydrates. And what it does is seek out carbohydrates and particularly sugars. So there's our link between tiredness and the metabolic predisposition for weight gain. Stress. Tired people are massively stressed. And one of the things of stress, of course, is loss of memory, which is what I sort of just then had a little lapse of. But stress is so much more. So if you're acutely stressed, not a great problem, but it's sustained stress associated with sleep loss that's the problem. So sustained stress leads to suppressed immunity. And so tired people tend to have higher rates of overall infection, and there's some very good studies showing that shift workers, for example, have higher rates of cancer. Increased levels of stress throw glucose into the circulation. Glucose becomes a dominant part of the vasculature and essentially become glucose intolerant, therefore diabetes too. Stress increases cardiovascular disease as a result of raising blood pressure. So there's a whole raft of things associated with sleep loss. that are more than just a mildly impaired brain, which is where I think most people think that sleep loss resides. So at this point in the talk, this is a nice time to think, well, do you think on the whole I'm getting enough sleep? So quick show of hands, who feels that they're getting enough sleep here? Oh, well, that's pretty impressive. Good, we'll talk more about that later, about what your tips. So most of us, of course, ask the question, well, how do I know whether I'm getting enough sleep? Well, it's not rocket science. If you need an alarm clock to get you out of bed in the morning, if you are taking a long time to get up, if you need lots of stimulants, if you're grumpy, if you're irritable, if you're told by your work colleagues that you're looking tired and irritable, chances are you are sleep deprived. Listen to them. Listen to yourself. What do you do? Well, and this is slightly offensive, sleep for dummies. Make your bedroom a haven for sleep. The first critical thing is make it as dark as you possibly can, and also make it slightly cool. Very important. Actually, reduce your amount of light exposure at least half an hour before you go to bed. Light increases levels of alertness and will delay sleep. What's the last thing that most of us do before we go to bed? We stand in a massively lit bathroom with looking into the mirror, cleaning our teeth. It's the worst thing we could possibly do to before we went to sleep. Turn off those mobile phones, turn off those computers, turn off all of those things that are also going to excite the brain. Try not to drink caffeine too late in the day. Ideally, not after lunch. Now, we said about reducing light exposure before you go to bed, but light exposure in the morning is very good at setting the biological clock to the light-dark cycle, so seek out morning light. Basically, listen to yourself. Wind down. Do those sorts of things that you know are going to ease you off into the honey-heavy dew of slumber. Okay, that's some facts. What about some myths? Teenagers are lazy. No. Poor things. They have a biological predisposition to go to bed late and get up late, so give them a break. We need 8 hours of sleep a night. That's an average. Some people need more, some people need less. And what you need to do is listen to your body. Do you need that much or do you need more? That's simple as that. Old people need less sleep. Not true. The sleep demands of the aged do not go down. Essentially, sleep fragments and becomes less robust, but sleep requirements do not go down. And the fourth myth is early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Well, that's wrong at so many different levels. There is no evidence that getting up early and going to bed early gives you more wealth at all. There's no difference in socioeconomic status. In my experience, the only difference between morning people and evening people is that those people that get up in the morning early are just horribly smug. Okay, so for the last part, the last few minutes, what I want to do is change gears and talk about some really new and breaking areas of neuroscience, which is the association between mental health, mental illness, and sleep disruption. We've known for 130 years that in severe mental illness, there is always, always sleep disruption. But it's been largely ignored. In the 1970s, when people started to think about this again, they said, yes, well, of course you have sleep disruption in schizophrenia because they're on antipsychotics. It's the antipsychotics causing the sleep problems, ignoring the fact that for 100 years previously, sleep disruption had been reported before antipsychotics. So what's going on? Lots of groups, several groups, are studying conditions like depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar, and what's going on in terms of sleep disruption. We have a big study, which we published last year, on schizophrenia, and the data were quite extraordinary. In those individuals with schizophrenia, much of the time they were awake during the night phase, and then they were asleep during the day. Other groups showed no 24-hour patterns whatsoever. Their sleep was absolutely smashed, and some had no ability to regulate their sleep by the light-dark cycle. They were getting up later and later and later and later each night. It was smashed. So what's going on? And the really exciting news is that mental illness and sleep are not simply associated, but they are physically linked within the brain. The neural networks that predispose you to normal sleep give you normal sleep, and those that give you normal mental health are overlapping. And what's the evidence for that? Well, genes that have been shown to be very important in the generation of normal sleep when mutated, when changed, also predispose individuals to mental health problems. And last year, we published a study which showed that a gene that's been linked to schizophrenia, which when mutated also smashes the sleep. So we have evidence of a genuine mechanistic overlap between these two important systems. Other work flowed from these studies. The first was that sleep disruption actually precedes certain types of mental illness. And we've shown that in those young individuals who are at high risk of developing bipolar disorder, they already have a sleep abnormality prior to any clinical diagnosis of bipolar. The other bit of data was that sleep disruption may actually exacerbate, make worse the mental illness state. My colleague Dan Freeman has used a range of agents which have stabilized sleep and reduced levels of paranoia in those individuals by 50%. So, what have we got? We've got in these connections some really exciting things. In terms of the neuroscience, by understanding the neuroscience of these two systems, we're really beginning to understand how both sleep and mental illness are generated and regulated within the brain. The second area is that if we can use sleep and sleep disruption as an early warning signal, then we have the chance of going in. If we know that these individuals are vulnerable, early intervention then becomes possible. And the third, which I think is the most exciting, is that we can think of the sleep centers within the brain as a new therapeutic target. Stabilize sleep in those individuals who are vulnerable. We can certainly make them healthier, but also alleviate some of the appalling symptoms of mental illness. So let me just finish. What I started by saying is, take sleep seriously. Our attitudes towards sleep are so very different from a pre-industrial age, when we were almost wrapped in a duvet. We used to understand intuitively the importance of sleep. And this isn't some sort of crystal-waving nonsense. This is a pragmatic response to good health. If you have good sleep, it increases your concentration, attention, decision-making, creativity, social skills, health. If you get sleep, it reduces your mood changes, your stress, your levels of anger, your impulsivity, and your tendency to drink and take drugs. And we finished by saying that an understanding of the neuroscience of sleep is really informing the way we think about some of the causes of mental illness, and indeed is providing us new ways to treat these incredibly debilitating conditions. Jim Butcher, the fantasy writer, said, "Sleep is God, go worship." And I can only recommend that you do the same.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. I probably have a bit of an Easter egg for you at the end of the credit. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. Cosmos is full.
It's March the 17th.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the...